Welcome to Mind Food Radio, Smart Thinking with Michael McHugh and Ben Starr.
And welcome aboard Mind Food Radio, Smart Thinking. I've been smart thinking all week. No hypochondria this week.
Really? Do you know what? I've got to say, I think the hypochondria is gone since you've been doing
this
show.
Well, this show's a therapy show for me.
I know.
It's become a therapy session.
The way you've brought that couch in, I think, is a little too much. Yes.
Now, on the show today, you've got some star-studded.
Well, I know. It is.
He's a favourite.
He is a favourite. And look, I have to be honest, he is my favourite MasterChef judge.
Yeah.
I think George can't hold a knife and fork properly.
What is that?
I don't know. It's really embarrassing.
And he shakes a lot.
And Gary screams at us.
Yeah.
You know, calm it down.
I know.
But what I love about Matt Preston, he knows the start. He knows what he's talking about. And he makes it fun and super accessible. So we got him on today's show.
Fantastic. And also coming up on the show, Jeremy Rolleston. Now, he had an interesting time in the 2010 Winter Olympics.
Well, yes.
Bit of an accident, but he's written a fabulous book, The Secrets of Successful People. All that and more coming up on today's program of Mind Food Radio.
Mind Food Magazine and Mind Food Radio. Together, smart thinking.
Well, if you were at a nightclub or sitting in a restaurant and you met this guy, you'd think, what an interesting job. Rob McGarvin joins us on the line. He's the Boundary Bent Olives CEO. What happens when you meet someone and you tell them all about this? And what do they say to you, Rob?
Well, it's surprising how many people don't know a lot about olive oil, but once you get chatting to them and they learn that extra virgin's the only olive oil that's the juice of the olive and not refined and the only mainstream cooking oil with all of the health benefits, they go away very pleased, usually.
How did you get into this business of olives? Is it really a big here in Australia, or is it still a very small industry?
No, it's grown quite a lot. A friend and I from college had a brainwave about 15 years ago that we'd plant some olive trees, and it's growing and growing and growing from there. Australia consumes about 45 million litres. We only produce about 15 million litres here domestically. And we export some of that. So there's a lot of room for growth here of our products in the market, but you know, we'll always need imports as well.
And in terms of olives, what are the things that you need to look out for? If someone was going to do this as a hobby farm, is there a lot of preparation involved with this type of industry?
Well, they say that you plant a vineyard for your children and an olive grove for your grandchildren. It's a very long-term investment.
Is it?
It's awfully tough, and I don't just say that flippantly.
Yeah.
They take a long time to grow. You've got to look after them well to make them fruit well. They won't die easily, but you won't get a lot of fruit easily either. So, look, it's for your own consumption, perfect. If you want to get into it commercially, have a good look at it, because it's a very competitive industry as far as cost of production and the price that, you know, that olive oil goes for.
Mm. And did you have to go overseas to learn how to do all this? I mean, it's a pretty detailed business, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. Look, my partner in the business, or who founded the business with me, Paul Redd, and he spent 3 months overseas just looking at what varieties we should plant. And, you know, we did a couple of years of research, and he found out that the varieties we needed to plant weren't available here in Australia, or if they were, we didn't know if they were true to type. So we actually imported all of those trees and, you know, had to wait for them to grow up. So it was a long, long time frame before we got the trees in the ground. But, you know, it's paying dividends, because we've got the varieties that are doing well and, you know, producing a lot of high-quality extra virgin olive oil and winning lots of awards with our brand Cobram Estate.
Fantastic. And where are you going to take the company next? I mean, where can we find your product first, and where are you going to take it?
Yeah, so Cobram Estate is our brand, and that's where, you know, our olives end up, and it's, you know, certainly we've got a huge focus on quality, and it's pretty readily available. And, you know, we're just really proud to be able to give people in Australia a high quality olive oil at a very competitive price, and you know, we just want to focus on that and keep pleasing customers who hopefully will keep buying our product.
Yeah, fantastic. And it's all Australian made, of course.
Yeah, absolutely. 100% Australian made, owned, produced. We're the farmers, the growers, the processors, the millers, the bottlers, the marketers,
yeah,
the packers, and all of those things in the middle.
And where are you based?
In Victoria.
Yeah. Yep.
So we've got 1.5 million trees in 3 sites in Victoria, and we do all of our packaging of the products near Geelong at Lara.
And what's it like at harvest season?
Oh, it's chaotic. We've got a few hundred people, you know, driving large machines and tractors and, you know, taking the fruit off the tree. And the machines are very specialised, and we develop them here in Australia. And you know, one of the reasons the product's such high quality is because it really, from time of picking to pressing, is only a few hours, and that's a key to having really high quality extra virgin olive oil.
Right.
And for all those people that don't know, the higher the quality extra virgin olive oil, the better it is for your health.
I didn't know that, so there you go. I've learned something new. A big tick, hey, for the cholesterol side of things.
Absolutely.
Well, Rob McGovern, we've been chatting with today. He is the CEO of Boundary Bent Olives. He's been chatting with us from Corbrum Estate there. And thank you very much for joining us today here on Mind Food Radio.
Not a problem. Thank you.
Mind Food Radio. Smart thinking. The perfect gift idea is a Mind Food magazine subscription. Visit mindfood.com today.
It's Mind Food Radio, and you're with Ben and Michael today. Well, A Life That Counts is a book that, well, came about from a devastating crash in the two-man bobsled at the 2010 Winter Olympic Games. And with us on the line today, I have Jeremy Rolleston to tell his story. How are you, Jeremy?
Good, thank you, Ben.
Very interesting story, and must have been a very confronting moment for you.
Yeah, look, it was a devastating moment. You know, it was my second Olympics, and I was in the best shape of my life, and I was really ready to break my Australian record, but I ended up on my head at the bottom of the track when we had an equipment failure, something very random. So, yeah, look, it was devastating. I did feel slightly embarrassed because the predominant thought was, oh, people couldn't think I'm this bad. But and it got a lot more attention than it would otherwise have got because there was a death on the track a week earlier, people might remember.
Yep.
Was it a failure? I guess as an athlete, you look things squarely in the face and you go, yes, it was a failure. I didn't perform anywhere near what I wanted to. In the big scheme of life, was it a failure? No. I mean, I got to my second Olympics and there are a lot of things around that campaign that were very successful. So that's always a matter of context, I guess.
Hmm. You went behind the scenes and talked to other successful Australians writing your book, including people like Gay Waterhouse, Dick Smith. What insights do you get from people like that?
I wanted people to have that social proof of, look, here's what these people do, and you can't ignore it because here's all the examples from all these famous Australians. And it was absolutely fascinating to interview them. And behind the scenes, I asked each of those people for specific reasons. So take Gay Waterhouse, for example. I specifically asked her to be in the book because I wanted to ask her about the fears that she had of failing her famous father as a race trainer. And everyone sees Gay now through the spring carnival, but they don't see what it was like before she bought her first horse, where she was asking her mum, can I even do this? And that is exactly the same moment as we all face and as many of the listeners face. And it's interesting for them to then be able to see, well how did Gay respond in that situation? And Matt Shervington is another great example, I think, because I wanted to ask him, did he regret not being the first white man to run under 10 seconds? Because to all intents and purposes, he should have been. And that answer that he gave with where he said, look, I did everything I could. I am absolutely disappointed that I wasn't the first white man to run under 10 seconds, but I have no regrets. I gave it all. And again, that's if you could bottle that little lesson, that difference between disappointment and regret and going for it and regretting the things that you don't do more than the things you do, that's really useful for people to know. Dick Smith, Gay Waterhouse, Matt Shervington, Louis Sparks, very different. They will always go for it. Now, they don't know if they'll get there. They don't know if they'll be world champion. They don't know if they'll be the fastest white man to run under 10 seconds, but they will go for it. So that was a very interesting point. And I think the second thing I'd say for listeners is, they all believe that the little things add up to the big things. So, yes, they've got a bigger picture of what they want to do, but in terms of their daily life, whether it's in sport or whether it's in work, they absolutely will do the little things well, and they just believe that they will all add up. So Gay Waterhouse spoke about this, for example, and she says, okay, well, what I will do, I will give the horses the best feed. I will give them the best jockeys. I will give them the best stables. And all of that for her will add up to a great preparation. And Louise Savage and James Tompkins said the same in their sport.
So I think it's fascinating the research that you've done, and maybe that knock on the head or that slide down the ramp into the world's media attention was meant to happen. Maybe it was part of your life's journey, you know?
Well, perhaps it was, and, you know, if I can help anyone out there, you know, live the life that they want to live, however they define success, then, you know, I'm a happy man.
Fantastic. Look, we've been chatting with Jeremy Rolleston today, a brand new book out called The Secrets Behind Successful People, A Life That Counts. Really, really cool to talk to you, and thank you for your time today, Jeremy.
Thank you, Ben. You're welcome.
This is Mind Food Radio. Smart thinking.
Well, we sit on furniture. We use it all the time. We're sitting in a cool studio today, and we thought, let's get a guy on the air who understands furniture today. And he's a furniture designer, Dan Gillingham, all the way in New Zealand. How are you, Dan?
Yeah, good, thanks.
How's furniture changed from the early days?
Traditionally, obviously, furniture pieces came from, were designed from a purpose point of view. So the likes of a buffet unit was designed, obviously, for that purpose. Today, I think a lot of that is stripped back, and in a lot of cases, a piece of furniture is set around more of a trend or a design style.
You know, when you look at furniture from yesteryear and today, you know, are we designing furniture to last a long time, or is it something that's a throwaway world now?
In some cases, I think we are, but to a large extent now, I think the consumer's been driven or conditioned, really, to think that it's okay to buy something without any real intention of keeping it.
So what turns you on about furniture? How did you get into all this business?
Well, no, I've always had a passion for furniture. I went through a design degree in New Zealand, and I've always designed for companies. So I've designed within a design team within a company, designing furniture for that company. For the last 8 years, I've been designing for a company called Design Mobel in New Zealand. I've recently just moved on from that and created my own company called The Ernest Workshop.
Mm-hmm.
We do live in a throwaway society, so any furniture that I design that comes out of The Ernest Workshop is all about being built to last, and that's the tagline that goes with my brand, Good Things Last. So when I set about designing a piece, I look at a need. I don't necessarily create a style around what I do. That sort of just comes out of what you do. It's the old adage of form follows function.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting when you look at furniture, though. I'm always amazed at the detail in some furniture and then the lack of detail in other furniture. And it all appeals to different markets. I know all that. But the sustainability side of it doesn't seem to be that important for most furniture makers today.
No, I see that trend is changing. Designers on the whole are now today a lot more equipped in knowing how to design something sustainably.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of tools out there that can be used.
In terms of furniture and you know, the design of all these things, where do you think the future of furniture is going to go?
I'd like to think it's heading back to more how it used to be. There will always obviously be the lower price point product, mm-hmm. which has a need and a consumer for that, but I'd like to think that consumers, you know, if they've got an old couch or something sitting at home, they, you know, do the right thing and sit on it for a bit longer, save up and buy a piece of furniture that is really going to truly reward them. Furniture pieces, you know, used to have a quality about them that people would fall in love with and grow a close sentimental attachment to. You know, we've all got stories of our grandparents that had a sideboard or an old armchair or something, and that's simply gone now because those sorts of pieces of furniture are no longer being manufactured.
Yeah. What's interesting, though, is, and I'd be interested to know from your experience, and I can tell you from mine, I've never gone out and bought furniture in my life.
Right.
Everything that's in my house has been from past generations, I suppose. So
yes,
I walk through and think there's a whole history attached to this. I wouldn't even know what to do to go and look for furniture.
When friends come to me asking me my advice, there's few consumers that can afford top dollar that will buy brand new pieces of furniture that are made of high quality. But what I often tell my friends is go out and look at second hand. You'll find incredibly good value of old pieces of furniture that still have a modern style that are very on trend today, if that's what they're looking for. And those pieces of furniture have been restored, and they can keep on being restored just by the way they're being made.
Well, Dan, thank you very much for joining us today on the program and talking about furniture design. Very, very interesting, and I like the sustainability edge that you're putting into your designs.
Thank you very much.
Mind Food Magazine and Mind Food Radio. Together, smart thinking.
Well, the Australian National Preventative Health Agency is a very important agency, and I've only just learned about this in the last 48 hours. It works in partnership with the Commonwealth and the state and territory governments, and the agency is driving the national capacity for change and innovation around preventative health policies and programs. So we thought today we would get Louise Sylvan on the line. She is the CEO to talk about one of their campaigns, the National Tobacco Campaign. How are you?
Hi, Ben. How are you?
Very interesting agency you're running there.
Yes, this is is a new initiative by the Commonwealth governments in agreement with the states and territories, as you said.
Mm.
And really, what they've looked at is things like our obesity and overweight levels,
mm-hmm.
Our use of alcohol, harmful use of alcohol, mm. and, of course, tobacco, which we'll be talking about today. And the agency's task is to really give some leverage to that and to get some terrific success stories also in obesity and in alcohol. And, of course, we've got a wonderful world record in reduction in tobacco use.
When you look around Australia now, it's a very different landscape when you look at people's bodies. And as a kid growing up, I never would have thought the word overweight would be something that I'd see in my early and late 30s, but it is happening everywhere. What is that all to do with?
Well, it sounds a bit simplistic to say it, but we've got increasingly sedentary lifestyles. We
yep.
sit at desks and, you know, we're not out doing physical work that much. And our diets have changed, Ben. We're now taking in, simply because of the way food is produced and so much fast food is available, we're taking in an awful lot of kilojoules that we're not using up in exercise. And you know what the result of that is, which is people are putting on quite a bit of weight.
No.
And yet we're having trouble making the connection there that it relates a great deal to, you know, how we eat, how we exercise, and, of course, in particular, whether we smoke, which has devastating effects on our health.
As a young boy, I watched my grandpa pass away of emphysema, and it left a legacy in my head that how people have to go through that terrible thing of trying to breathe, and it's something that they could have stopped when they started something. And we're here to talk about the word tobacco, and we use it quite loosely, but there's a lot of laws going into effect that are changing the way packaging's happening. What sort of effects is these campaigns or other campaigns for national tobacco having on our world of health?
Well, our national tobacco campaigns, and we're about to go into another phase of this shortly, our tobacco campaigns have delivered Australians some of the lowest smoking rates in the world. We lead the world in outcomes, and we lead the world in action.
Mm.
But once people have started to smoke, as you know, Ben, it's very difficult to give up. This is an addictive substance.
Mm.
So part of the national tobacco campaign that we've launched is a new application for people, and it's called My Quit Buddy.
Mm.
It's an iPhone and now an Android version in the market. And it's really designed to give people a buddy that stands beside them the whole time that they're trying to quit, because people try on, you know, almost 10 times often before they actually finally succeed. So they need a buddy to do that. And it's designed to really, you know, enable them to hit the panic button when that craving is coming through. And I love particularly that it lets you see every single day how much you are saving from not smoking. A lot of people have told us that they've set themselves a goal, like taking the kids to Disneyland,
yes.
and it shows them every single day how close they are to saving that money to their goal. So these are real encouragements to people to give it up.
Yeah, really, really cool. And of course, National Tobacco Campaign. For more details, you can go to the website there, Quit Now, and get all those details. Well, look, I look at it this way. I'm not a finance expert, but the more people we can stop smoking, the more money that we can save in our health system from treating people that have been smoking is more money that can be spent on other diseases and finding cures for them, don't you think?
Oh, that's absolutely right. And it can be spent in the health system, but it can be spent elsewhere too.
Exactly.
I mean, spend that on kids' education and so on. I mean, these are good ways to use money.
Or we could all go to Disneyland.
Well, that's right. We could do that too, Ben.
Well, thank you very much for your time today. It was lovely to talk to you, Louise, and very, very insightful.
Thanks very much, Ben. A pleasure.
This is Mind Food Radio, smart thinking.
I'm really excited about this interview here on Mind Food Radio. This guy we watch on TV, we see him do the food critiquing of contestants at MasterChef. But what's really interesting is Preston was educated in Sussex in Worth School and graduated from the University of Kent with a BA Honours in Politics and Government. So Matt Preston joins us on the line from Politics and Government. How did you get into this world of food, Matt?
Well, I think it's one of those stumbles, isn't it? They always say you should be lucky in life, and I've been really lucky. When I moved to Australia, I started writing about television, got paid for watching The Box, and
yeah.
then after 5 years of that, someone rang me up, a mate of mine rang me up, said, I'm doing a new magazine, do you want to write about food for me, do you want to review restaurants for me? So I went, well, gee, getting paid for eating out is even better than getting paid for watching television. So I grabbed it with both hands, and kind of I haven't really looked back since. It was about 15 years ago, and I've been writing recipes for about 10, so now finally got it together to think of a good enough idea to put into book form, and here we have 100 best recipes.
Now, the other thing I wanted to ask you, you know, some of your biggest cooking triumphs, I didn't know that you can do jams.
Oh, I love jam. Jam is one of those moments when you first make your first jam, you go, wow, how easy is that and how delicious. And, you know, to make a raspberry jam that's pretty much better than any in the shops, you know, it's as simple as some frozen raspberries, because, I mean, again, frozen raspberries are normally cheaper, unless it's raspberry season, but frozen raspberries, some cheap sugar and a lemon. It delivers in terms of brightness, you know. The homemade raspberry jam is much more vibrant than often the shop-bought one, because you can use a little less sugar, because, again, you can make a small batch, so it doesn't have to, you know, so you can reduce the sugars there, obviously, to preserve it. But if you can eat the jam within 3-4 days, you keep it in the fridge, then it can really be much more about the fruit.
Now, you talk about brightness. Before I get to the book again, brightness, where do you get your fashion sense from? I love it.
I've always dressed out of op shops. That since I was probably about 18, and, you know, I'm a young man with no money, trying to kind of look a bit peacocky.
Yeah.
I do love that kind of peacocky sense of fashion. And you know, the great thing is, I don't really care what other people think about what I wear. So that combination, you know, and I love the fact that you know, when you walk around the streets and you see what blokes are wearing now, you know, when I first arrived in Australia, it was, you know, pale blue shirts, dark blue suits, maybe charcoal suits, that was it. Now they're wearing lavender shirts and pink shirts, and maybe not wearing a tie. We're, you know, we're much looser.
Now, the book again, the title of the book?
Matt Preston's 100 Best Recipes.
100 Best Recipes. What's your favourite one in the book?
As one of my mother-in-law's recipes, which is for lamb braised with pineapple juice, and it gets this wonderful, rich, tangy gravy.
Oh, yeah.
It takes about 5 minutes to prepare, and then you just bang in the oven for a couple of hours. The creaminess of that gravy, the creaminess of the walnut, but then the crunch of the walnut, and then that lovely meat that just falls apart the fork.
Now, if Michael was here with me at the moment, he would have glazed over and conked out on the floor with sheer excitement.
Michael and I have had a couple of epic meals together.
Recently, I was at his place and he was doing sausage rolls. I'd never seen someone get so involved. It was hysterical.
but you see, a sausage roll is I think the main thing with sausage rolls, and this is something that I'll be making, my latest discovery of sausage rolls, is you pipe a line of the meat in the middle of the puff pastry, makes it twice as easy to roll out and twice as quick, and you get really neat sausage rolls. So, I mean, I'm constantly, you know, I think that's the great thing.
Yeah.
When you're involved in that, you're constantly learning, you're constantly discovering new tricks, and then you want to pass them on.
Well, Matt Preston's new book is called 100 Best Recipes. I reckon you should get it and put it under the Christmas tree for those you love this year, hey?
That's convenient, isn't it?
It's convenient. It's just out in time for Christmas. Well, Matthew, thank you very much for taking the time to chat to us, and thanks for inspiring us with all your colour and your wonderful moves on the TV, and we look forward to seeing you for many more years to come.
You're too sweet. Thank you so much.
Mind Food Radio. Smart thinking. The perfect gift idea is a Mind Food magazine subscription. Visit mindfood.com today.
Well, Barbara Toner has an interesting story to tell. Yes, she's an author and she's written this fabulous book, Because I Love You, and she's going to tell us what it's all about. How are you, Barbara?
I'm very well, thank you.
Now, mother and daughter relationships, are they special?
Special. They are unbelievably special. They're probably no more special than fathers and sons, or mothers and sons and fathers and daughters, but they're unique in the tensions that can occur between mothers and daughters. It's kind of like, you know, the young bull locking horns with the old bull when the time comes to declare head of the tribe. And the same sort of thing happens, I think, with mothers and daughters in the household, but the mother clings to her position for dear life, and that's probably what this book is all about.
What is a mother's position?
Bossy, in charge, knowing everything, being the most loving person on earth who will be there to support you and protect you, whatever happens.
Mm.
That's how I see myself. I mean, I'm unnecessarily bossy. I can't help myself. I'm hardwired to be bossy.
Mm.
And I think what happens is that mothers raise their families for something maybe like 30 years, during which time they're the people who are the last word on how life should be lived. And, you know, from the age of 11, your daughter is saying, no, it's not. But, you know, you are clinging on and saying, yes, it is, because I know more. And at a certain point, you don't really know more, but you still have this overweening urge to be protective and to say what you think might spare your children from any pain and suffering that you've either experienced yourself or you see coming their way. So you have to tell them how to do it. And they really don't need it. They really don't want it. But you absolutely have to say it.
For yourself as a mother, what has motherhood taught you?
Well, the first thing it always teaches you is that you can't put yourself first in every situation. You have to put yourself second, because I think you begin life by thinking, well, if you're in a family, you're not, you're just one of a family, but slowly, slowly your ego starts to take over and you put yourself first.
Mm.
Once you've had children, you absolutely cannot, because this tiny baby must be placed before all of your needs and considerations. So that's the first lesson you learn. And you continue to learn that one forever and ever and ever, which is why I suppose you get to the stage when you've got grown-up daughters where you're so used to not putting yourself first and putting your children first that they continue to be the paramount thought in your mind, even though they've set up units with other and have families of their own, and they've got their own units over there that they're looking after, but you're still locked in the unit that involves them or in which they have been placed first. And it's a very tricky situation.
Yeah. My sister is about to have her first baby, and she's one of four of us. There's three boys and herself. And it's very, very interesting to watch my brothers react around her, including myself. For us, this is a big, big moment. You know, we never thought my sister would ever have children, you know, that type of thing. But it's been very interesting to watch how the boys are reacting to my sister becoming a mother. And what advice do you have to people that are about to have their first baby?
Get ready.
Thank God for those brothers.
Well, you do need a support network. I it's a very heartwarming thing to have hear you say what you've just said. How lovely for her that she's got three brothers who are so involved and so concerned that they're watching like hawks and wanting to be there. I mean, I think that's fantastic. You do need a support network, and you're so grateful for it when you've got it. The job of the support network is not to do what you want to do, which is say, are you sure you're doing the right thing? You have to assume she is doing the right thing. Well, it's the right thing for her. And all you can do is say, I know you're very tired. Can I take the baby for a walk?
It's funny, yesterday I was in the office and she said, quick, she grabbed my hand and put it onto her tummy, and you could feel the little baby's feet moving, and she said to me, Ben, can you believe that's real? And it's absolutely surreal for us.
Are you thrilled?
Oh, I'm over the moon. I can't wait. I secretly have been going out buying stuff. I don't even know what sex it is. She doesn't want to know. But my mother and I are beside ourselves. We go into baby shops and I go to my mum, can you believe we're actually doing this? This is hysterical.
Oh, no. How lovely. This is the thing about having a baby, is it does bring such joy.
Thank you very much for your time today. A really interesting perspective there. And the book's called I Love You, Mother
because
and Daughter.
Because I love you.
Yes. And we can get it in all the good bookstores, hey?
Well, and if you can't, you go and say to them, please get this book in because it's invaluable.
So that's Barbara Turner. We've been chatting to her today. Her new book called Because I Love You. And this is Mind Food Radio. Now, my next guest, growing up with a Lebanese mother, food, cooking and eating were an integral part of her childhood. And as a young girl, she learned how to cook mostly with meat, chicken, vegetables, white rice, garlic and olive oil. It's a very interesting combination. They say eating the diet of your ancestors is good, but good health starts in your kitchen. And Janella Purcell joins us today. She's an award-winning nutritionalist, naturopath and cook. And she talks about her wonderful new book called Good Health Starts in Your Kitchen. Janella, how are you?
I'm wonderful,
thank you. Look, I have to say, when you look at cooking and things like that, you had a little bit of an interesting foray into the world of cooking because you grew up with it. But, you know, you said in part of your bio here, you also battled your diet and you had to look at certain things in your life. How did that all happen?
Well, I mean, it's kind of a mystery, really, but I think, you know, the older I'm getting and the more study and the more, you know, self-awareness you have, I think I was just a really sensitive child and took on everybody else's problems and was really concerned about everyone, everything, and it made for poor digestion. You know, when you get anxious, your tummy hurts and you get a bit nauseous or queasy. So I think that was probably what was happening, because I couldn't eat meat or rice or, you know, pasta for sure, or dairy. So there was all of these foods that we were all eating at home that I just couldn't eat. So I had to find a new way to eat, new foods to eat. And being in the 70s in Brisbane, you know, there wasn't a whole lot of options. It wasn't like I could go down to the local health food store and go, hey, have you got any miso?
But I was reading your blog earlier and I thought, gosh, sinus problems and allergies, I never used to have any of that, but you've got a cure for that as well.
Well, nature has.
Yeah, thank God
sure.
for that.
I mean, I am a big believer in not just detoxing your life, and that means taking out the unnecessary chemicals in your fruit and vegetables and all your packaged and canned foods and imported foods, but also in your cleaning products and your body products, like, you know, deodorant and cleansers. But stop retoxing. So we're retoxing all the time by just living in our environment, by sucking in all the free radicals from environmental pollutants, and you know, we don't need to be doing that. And it seems really overwhelming for people. It's like, it's just all too hard, so I don't want to know any of it.
Yes.
And go into the too hard basket and go away. But that's why I continue to write, because it's so easy. It's just that we don't know how.
Yeah.
And I've done a lot of this work because I had to do it for myself. So now I share it, and it's such a joy to be on this path, to be in having it as your life's purpose, to be sharing this information, because it's really, you know, it's so important. It's about our lives, and it's about the future of us and our grandkids and our planet. So why wouldn't I teach people how not to use that deodorant, but use that one, and don't have that toothpaste, but to have that one?
Mm. Now, the psychology of food, in your book, you go on about the Whole Food Kitchen, and you share 130 tempting recipes. What should people expect to see when they flick through the book and start to do some cooking?
Gorgeous, yummy, healthy food.
Mm.
And also, I've coded each of the recipes dairy-free, gluten-free, vegan, veggie, or raw, because there's lots of people on different diets at the moment. But I really want to take the myth out of what people think about healthy food. They think it's boring, and that your life is boring, and that you're boring, and you're never going to have a drop of wine again, and you're never going to have pasta again.
Yeah.
It's not true. It's about what you do at home most of the time.
Yeah.
So I want people to go... I mean, a lot of people look through my recipe books, or some people don't go, well, that can't be healthy because it looks so good and it tastes so good. But this is just normal. I think this is just normal food without all the additives. There's ways to make food really beautiful, but you need to know how to do it.
Yeah.
And that's what they're going to find. And also in there, I've got a pantry list and also what utensils to have. I only have one pan that I use for things. You don't have a whole lot of clutter. I have a few utensils. Keep it really simple. And just, I'm showing people how to make it simple for themselves, because life's really busy and they do put it in the too hard basket, and I want them to see that it's not, and it's actually of vital importance that you get your health and your diet in order.
Well, look, good health starts in your kitchen. The brand new book called Janella's Whole Food Kitchen. It's a great book, so make sure you grab a copy, and a great Christmas gift coming up not too far away as well.
Oh, that's a good idea.
There you go. And congratulations on your new book.
That's an absolute pleasure, and many thanks.
Mind Food Radio, Smart Thinking with Michael McHugh and Ben Starr.
Well, folks, I've had to put the sunglasses on. Michael has walked in today wearing stripes. Stripes should be worn with certain clothes and certain styles, but today he's really pushed the limits. Carolyn, you're sitting there in your office thinking, what the hell?
Carolyn, tell me stripes are in.
They are definitely in, and I'm just wondering which way you're wearing them. Are they horizontal or are they vertical?
They're vertical and they're black and white.
Oh, my goodness.
Should stripes, when you're wearing them, should you wear them horizontal? Don't they make you look bigger when they're horizontal or not?
Well, that's kind of been challenged recently.
Right.
It used to be the unspoken rule that stripes look best going up and down, not round and round.
Mm.
But new research is challenging this long-held belief. Initially, Thompson turned the fashion world upside down a couple of years ago when he compared vertical and horizontal stripes on two-dimensional drawings of women in striped dresses and on 3D cylinders. And he found there was no support of the notion that horizontal lines are fattening on clothing.
Oh.
Findings were published in 2010 and were supported by the theory of a 19th century Prussian psychologist. See, this is very serious. Called Hermann von Helmholtz, I think is how you say his name.
Mm.
That ladies with cross stripes on them make the figure look taller. Now, she was very sceptical of Thompson's findings and wondered what the result would be if the experiment was conducted on real people rather than drawings. So at the International Science Festival in Edinburgh in April this year, 500 visitors were shown videos of models wearing stripes and asked to rate how tall or wide they looked. And the results showed that the vertical stripes actually make people look taller and horizontal stripes wider.
But I've got to be honest, if I wear a T-shirt with, you know, like horizontal stripes, I can look a little barrel-like. You know, there you go, honest about it. But
yeah.
I don't know. And if I wear them the other way, it does give me, whether it is, I am tall, but it does give the illusion of being taller. Do you not think?
Well, it depends. See, I interviewed Gok Wan about this about a year ago, and I asked him this question. And this is when, you know, this Thompson's research had come out, basically, and everyone was going, oh, God, now the vertical stripes are wrong, and you should wear horizontal stripes. And Gok was like, God, really? Is that true? And he didn't even know about the study, and he was shocked and said, well, I've always been taught that vertical stripes are more flattering.
Hmm.
And the same with, you know, Dior. He wrote in his style Bible that stripes used horizontally can be very charming, but not for plump people because they are very shortening.
We seem to have the Country Road catalogue at home last night. I was looking through, and it's all stripes, you know, for men and women. So
absolutely, no, it's still very much, you know, it's a very classic look.
Yeah,
the black and white or the black and the white and navy. But in recent years, you know, Prada also mixed it up by putting out sort of like licorice all sort type stripes out there with, you know, your big blacks,
yeah,
with
that's right, they did too.
Your oranges, and then people have now coloured those up with beautiful pastel colours all in within one garment. So there's lots of different stripes out there at the moment.
Carolyn, yeah. Thank you very much. We look forward to getting out there in the shops and going online and buying
it.
Stripes for summer.
Yep,
so
more
there
stripes.
You go. Still inconclusive, really, and I guess just choose a stripe that suits you best.
Exactly. Thank you very much.
Talk to you next week.
Cheers.
And that's a wrap, as we say in the business. Michael, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Ben. What are you up to this weekend?
This weekend, I'm preparing for another hypochondria session. We're getting ready for next week's show.
Of course, you will be thinking about it.
Actually, next week, we're going to chat to someone who, does a lot of work with, you know, sinus stuff.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So she's coming up on the program.
But how bad is the pollen at the moment?
Oh,
God.
We'll speak to Angus next week about that. What are you up to?
I am off to New Zealand, where I'm looking forward to celebrating my sister's birthday. I was almost going to say how old she was.
Yeah, there you go.
It involves a dress-up and a theme.
Fantastic. We'll hear all about that next time here on Mind Food.
Mind Food Radio Smart Thinking was produced in the studio of Radio Australasia. Produced by Ben Starr and Brian Newington and Patrick Kayrouse. Bogart Torelli speaking.